Good. Well, Happy New Year. Welcome to Vox on the first Sunday of Epiphany. And so this morning, I'd like to have a conversation about traveling and road tripping. Any road trippers in here who like to travel? So why don't we do this? While people are still lining up for coffee, getting a seat, just turn to a neighbor, share a memorable trip that you've taken, maybe as a kid, maybe recently. All right, I'll give you a couple minutes. Go. All right. So who's taken a memorable trip in the last 2 years? Show of hands, okay. How many of us like to fly? How many prefer to drive? Boat people? Got some boat people? Okay. I was thinking through this, and some of my favorite memories in my childhood were with my family on road trips. We had a maroon Chevy Malibu, and we would pull this pop-up trailer. And I have all these fond memories of laughter and arguments and fighting for elbow space. And I grew up in an immigrant family, so food was a thing. So being from a Chinese family, instead of camp stew and sandwiches, we had rice cookers and soy sauce eggs. That was a thing. Okay. So when my wife and I got married, we were living in Detroit, and I remember it was our first Christmas as a married couple. And so we didn't know how it would go. We woke up, we exchanged gifts, and then our entire Christmas morning was like finished in 5 minutes. We're like, Merry Christmas! And then we just sat there. We're like, what should we do? And then this family from the church that I was working at, they were all going snowboarding, skiing. They're like, hey, why don't you come along? So packed our stuff, our gear, we went up to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. After our first day on the slopes, I remember sitting there. So we had packed our gear, and we had packed each a packet of hot chocolate. So we were sitting there, we were warming, drinking hot chocolate, and then we smelled like these beautiful smells of like Chinese food coming from the next room. And we're like, where is that coming from? So we open our door, and we knock on the door of the family who invited us. And they opened the door, and there was the rice cooker, the soy sauce eggs, the chicken and noodles. They were like, come on in. And we're like, ah, it was so wonderful. And so these trips, these memories, the food, they bring back the people that we loved most. And I had such rich memories. And so for centuries, this idea of traveling was formative to the language of our faith. But some of us, I think this word journey has gotten so overused. If I use the word journey, all of your eyes are just going to roll so far back into your heads, I'm going to have to shake you to get it back up, right? But I want to propose that this idea of travel, when Jesus uses metaphors of narrow and wide roads, he talks about gates. He says, I'm the life, I'm the way, I'm the path that you journey through to find a deeper and rich life. I want to propose that maybe that's a metaphor, better metaphor than what some of us have been given. For me, because we kind of lost that language of travel and movement, the faith that I was given was kind of an ideological box of propositional truths. And you kind of memorize this box, and then you defend it. Once you've defended it enough, you can use this box to attack people. And then the goal was to coerce people through fear to cram as many people into that box as possible, right? And I propose if that's become our faith, maybe it's worth reinserting the language of pilgrimage and travel. The rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel says it like this. He says, faith is not clinging to a shrine, but an endless pilgrimage of the heart. The current pope says it like this. Life is, he uses the J word, he says, life is a journey. But when we stop, if you stop in that journey, things don't go right. And so this morning, I wanted to begin a conversation. I thought it'd be appropriate for Epiphany, maybe in the beginning of this year. What if faith became more than propositional truths already signed and sealed, but an endless discovery of a faith and life and mystery? What if it wasn't just ideology to protect and defend and divide, but what if it were a trip of faith where all of us are invited in? And so this morning, we're going to look at the first trip or perhaps pilgrimage that Jesus takes as a very young boy. Matthew's the only writer that tells this story. And he's trying to mirror the pilgrimage that the ancient Hebrews had in and out of Egypt. And so this morning, we're going to be in Matthew chapter 2. We'll have it on the screens. Go ahead and read verses 13 through 16, and then we'll walk through it. All right, Matthew 2, 13 through 16. Go. All right, let's pick this up in verse 13. So now after they had left, so they're talking about the foreigners that came and they were looking for Jesus following the star. They had left. An angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. He said, "Get up, take the child and his mother, flee to Egypt. Remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him." And Joseph got up, took the child and his mother by night, went to Egypt, and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I have called my son." So there's a couple things here worth noting. I think first, when we think Epiphany, I think a lot of us are like, oh, it's Epiphany, right? We're going to experience God and his presence, and it's going to be amazing and beautiful. And I just want to suggest that maybe often Epiphany is disruptive. And maybe that's helpful for us to see it in that way. And in this story, you've got this young teenage family, and their lives are utterly and completely disrupted. Then secondly, Mary and Joseph, at most, they were 14 through 17. So just to give you context, if they were at Vox, our middle school, high school ministry is called Zaman. Mama Mary and Joseph would be a part of Zaman. This morning, the high schoolers and middle schoolers had their mentor meetup. We would assign Mama Mary a mentor. Here's your mentor. Joseph, here's your mentor. We had an Advent celebration for the Zaman. It was at the Torchy's trailer park. They would have joined our white elephant gift exchange, in which I think these were the items that actually were given. There was a fart bag and a selfie stick. So Mary and Joseph would have fought over these things, okay? So just to give you context. So in these opening verses, what I think is astounding is this. You have the most powerful man in the region. He was a dictator, unparalleled. And somehow he was threatened by a powerless tiny toddler. And I wonder if one way to look at it could be like this. So if you have someone whose belonging is based on achievement in what they do, Herod was the king, literally. And somehow the one who comes into this world where his belonging is in just who he is, he's love incarnate, somehow he doesn't fit into that world. And somehow power is so threatened by the powerless that Jesus' first memories, his first memories are as a refugee. And I wonder how many of us, we have memories where we didn't belong. I'm sure we all do. It's a universal experience, isn't it? I remember last year, I was invited to this birthday party. It was the birthday party of a one-year-old. And are the aunts here? Is Gabe and Gina here? Okay. So they had a one-year-old, and it was their one-year party. And so I was like, oh, okay, I've been to one-year-old parties. I've had two former one-year-olds. Shouldn't be a thing. I didn't think about it. So they were having it up north at Maggiano's, which is an Italian restaurant. And I knew that. I had never been there. For some strange reason, in my mind, I was picturing, do you remember that place called Buca di Beppo? Okay. I don't know why I had that in my mind. So it was on a Monday, which is usually the day I ride my bike. And it was up north. So I was like, oh, I'll just ride my bike there. It'd be awesome. So I get there and I open these large, tall wooden doors of Maggiano's. And it was just much nicer than I thought it would be. So I open these doors. And if you've been to Maggiano's, it's kind of like Buca di Beppo is like the child's table of Maggiano's. Okay, so I walk in, it's dark, these high ceilings. I'm now ushered into a private banquet room, which is a huge banquet room. I open the doors and I see all these round tables. There's a seating chart and everyone there is dressed in like a dress shirt, tie, pants, suit. And I just got off my bike. To my credit, I brought a t-shirt to change into. Okay, so the entire time I'm sitting there at this table trying to hide, just like eating appetizers. And then Gina and Gabe stand up. They're like, oh, thank you, everyone, for coming to our birthday party. We go to this wonderful church called Vox, and we'd like to invite the pastor to come up and pray. And I was like, no, ixnay on their air prayer. No, no, no. So I go up. This is me walking up. There's a picture here. This is me praying for them. This is me praying, blessing their one-year-old. Next picture. And I turn around, and John, Harmon, Wayne, they're rolling. And then this is the group picture. This is me trying to hide behind my wife. So that happened. I now know what Korean one-year-old parties are like now. I now know. All right, you can take that off the screen. But this sense of belonging, and that was just kind of like a fun little embarrassment. But we, maybe many of us, have experienced deeper senses of where we don't belong that have been hard and painful through our childhood, where we don't belong maybe because of the color of our skin or our height or the socioeconomic class we come from and our education or our talent. And then we spend our entire life, I've spent my entire life trying now to belong. And I wonder if in the season of Epiphany, what if this sense of belonging were an invitation to a deeper belonging, a deeper reality, a yoke that's a little lighter to carry. And in this story, you have the one who belonged. He was the king. And somehow Jesus comes into this world and he doesn't fit in. In John 17, Jesus says it like this. And I've never read this verse in the context of this belonging, but I think it makes sense. He's praying for us. This is his priestly prayer. And he says, he's talking to the Father, I'm coming to you now, but I say these things while I'm still in this world of competition, of belonging for things you do and accomplish. That's the world I live in. But I'm praying that they, us, may have the full measure of joy within them, inside of them. So if I've given them your word I have given them your word and the world has hated them. They didn't belong in this Darwinian world, for they are not of the world. They don't belong to that world any more than I am of that world. And my prayer is that you, not that you take them out, but that as they're in there, you protect them from the evil one, from the evil voices that tell them that they're not enough, that they have to earn more, they have to be better looking, they have to achieve more. I pray that you'll protect them from that evil one, from that voice. They are not of this world as I am not of it. So make them different by the truth. Your word is truth. You sent me into the world, I have sent them into the world. And as I'm different, I didn't live in this world of achievement and belonging and stuff and exterior, that they too may be truly different in the same way. And what if in this season of Epiphany, what if in those moments where we're not comfortable, where we don't fit in, where maybe it's an invitation that maybe we're not supposed to belong in that world? And I'll just say this, my hope that at Vox, if anyone steps through these doors, if you're here this morning, you belong. That's it. And I forget, and we forget, and that's why we become a sacramental community. And we come to this table, and we say the world outside is about achievement and success and looks and skin color. And when we come here because of who we are, because of what Christ has done, we belong. And so in this story, you have Herod, the one who's winning at this, and then this teenage couple on the side of the road as refugees running to Egypt. Let's pick up the story. When Herod saw that he had been tricked by the wise men. So earlier in the story, the foreigners are coming. They're like, hey, so I hear that there's this new king coming. And Herod's like, what, a king? Why don't you tell me where he's going to be? Just out of curiosity. I would like to, I love toddlers. I would like to visit this toddler, right? So these men, these foreigners, they're onto him and then they don't return his way. And then Herod is upset. He's threatened by this. So when Herod saw that he'd been tricked by the wise men, he was infuriated, and he sent and killed all the children in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that he had learned from the wise men. Then was fulfilled what had been spoken through the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, wailing in loud lamentation. Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be consoled because they are no more. So this is the thing. If you're in this Darwinian game, if you're playing the game of I belong because of what I achieve and do, even if you're at the top, it is exhausting. When you get to the top, you're going to have to fight for staying at the top, right? Jay-Z says it like this. He says, most kings get their heads cut off with the same sword they knight you, they gone good knight you with. That's only half if they like you. That ain't even the half what they might do. Don't believe me, ask Michael. I think Jordan? I think that's what he's talking about? Okay, keep going. See Martin, see Malcolm, see Biggie, see Pac, see success and its outcome. See Jesus, see Judas, see Caesar, see Brutus. See success is like suicide. Most kings get their head cut off. Keep on climbing till you reach the top. Keep on coming if they're ready or not. Most kings get their heads cut off. The king, they want to be the king. That Jay-Z, dropping wisdom, right? So that's the thing. If you're playing this game, even if you're at the top, it's relentless, right? It's exhausting. It's a heavy yoke to carry. And then Herod somehow is so threatened, he flexes his muscles and devastation and trauma and unthinkable trauma happens. And just imagine the trauma of the parents in Bethlehem. Imagine Mary and Joseph as teenagers alone on the side of the road, and maybe they get wind that this is happening. They're not even with their family members to grieve, and there's just grief and trauma and violence. So at this point, I think, okay, God, you're the king of kings, right? So if Herod flexes, you flex back, right? Deal with this violence and deal with power with more power. And I want God to come in with like a right jab, body blow, uppercut, like a, oh, you can fireball, like something, right? Do something. There's people dying. Fix this, right? Fight power with power. Fight injustice with justice. And it's infuriating that every time, instead of God coming with power and fighting that with more power, violence with more violence, every time he enters into trauma and he enters into it and immerses himself and born into it to find healing. It's like in the garden when the soldiers come with the sword, and Peter's like, I got a sword, right? And then he cuts the soldier's ear and Jesus said, no. And he takes it and he enters into that trauma and that violence to heal. And I think sometimes in Epiphany, I see the macro things and the problems of this world. And I just want God to, God, just fix it. Come on. Like this world that we're living on, do something. And I wonder if time and again, he invites us into it. And maybe to examine the violence and the trauma in our own lives. And the invitation is to be healed. I was listening to a podcast. Do you guys listen to On Being? It's an NPR podcast on faith. And she was interviewing Rachel Yehuda. She teaches psychiatry and neuroscience at Mount Sinai. And so she started researching decades ago stress that was happening in rats. And her research went from rats, and then she started studying veterans, and then to Holocaust survivors. She came from a community of Holocaust survivors in St. Louis. And she started studying that. And what she found, to her surprise, was a lot of the trauma and violence was being passed down biologically to the next generation. And she was interviewing Holocaust survivors' children that didn't experience it themselves. And the level of cortisone and the actual DNA changed. And then she said this. She says, her father's a rabbi, so she comes from the Jewish tradition. She says, in Ezekiel, the fathers ate sour grapes and the children's teeth were set on edge. She said, it's right there in the Bible. It's rhetorical. And she says, but the idea is that it's a hard thing to imagine that if your father ate sour grapes, the children's teeth will be rotted. And she said, yet the science is teaching us that exact thing. Okay, so we have trauma, and what she's showing is both the trauma and the violence, and she says on the flip side of it, healing. When someone is healed, they biologically change and is passed down to the next generation. So the tie-in here, stay with me, it's a little complicated. So there are several theologians that talk about sin in the language of trauma. And they say, what if we live among the human species? And if you were to take the behavior that comes out of someone who's experienced trauma, PTSD, and out of the pain they feel, their behavior is affected by that. And if you just change the behavior, but they don't find healing, it doesn't matter. It's not true healing. And so these theologians say this. That's why when Jesus on the cross, he said, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. The actions that are coming out of pain, they don't know what they're doing. Jesus says, I've come not for the healthy. They're not actually healthy. Maybe they're just not conscious or aware of the pain that's causing these actions. But he says, I've come for the sick, and that there's healing. And I want so badly to deal with these macro problems of the world. And there's a place for that, rightly so. But what if for us in this epiphany, maybe part of this pilgrimage, is this invitation into our own wounds, our own trauma, to find healing? You know, maybe one thing we can consider is this. So when we have trauma, what we do then is we cope with we cope by fitting into the world with success and being more beautiful and being more educated, right? We kind of climb that ladder. We kind of use what Herod is doing to cope. And then at some point, that coping, that rug gets pulled under, and then we start coping with our inability to cope, and that comes from some of the shadow behaviors of slander or self-medication. And so for us, this is why we've introduced the language of the Enneagram, because for all of us, in our tendencies, we have a way of coping. So I'll give you an example of myself. So I'm a head type. Remember, I talked about that. So within the head type, there are three types, and they go by numbers. I'm a seven. Is anyone familiar with this? Do we have any sevens in here? Okay, a handful. So sevens are the adventurers. They're the optimists. They love change. That's why sevens, like myself, we hear that faith is a journey and a road trip. We're like, what? That sounds fun. We love that. Okay. So the amazing thing, what I've discovered in recent years, is my coping mechanism is I avoid my pain by having fun. My sadness looks like happiness. I'm out just doing more adventures, trying to avoid the actual pain in my life. And so for us, what if we began conversations and just talked about, okay, maybe this is how I cope. Maybe these are the ways that I'm distracting. And in it, that the promise then is healing. And so in this story, we have Herod, and he flexes his muscles. He's threatened by this toddler, and tragedy and trauma happens. And then the story ends, and there's this strange twist of fate that's almost cruel to Mary and Joseph. So we get to verse 19. When Herod died, an angel of the Lord suddenly appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt. Get up, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel. For those who were seeking the child's life are dead. Then Joseph got up, took the child and his mother, and went to the land of Israel. Excuse me. But when he heard that Archelaus was ruling over Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. And after being warned in a dream, he went away to the district of Galilee. There he made his home in a town called Nazareth, so that what had been spoken through the prophets might be fulfilled. He would be called a Nazarene. So do you know and understand what's happening here? So Herod finally dies. So they've been waiting. Historians say maybe 4 to 8 years they've been in Egypt, maybe living on the side of the road, homeless. Okay, they finally get word that Herod's dead. And so for years, all of us would have done this. You don't blame teenagers, because for years they would have just said, when I get home, things are going to be fine. When I get home, we're finally going to have shelter. When we get home, everything will be fixed. They finally get home and they find that Herod is dead, but his son Archelaus has taken over. This is like going to North Korea and you find that Kim Jong-il has died only to be taken over by Kim Jong-un. Like crazy just replaced crazy, right? And so their dream of this home is gone and it's shattered and they have to move again, and they move to Nazareth. But I wonder how many of us have that version of when I get home, when I get that job, when I find that spouse, when I have that child, when I find that vocation, when I find the right church, when I finally buy a home. And then we get there and we find that it isn't what we thought it would be. And I wonder if maybe Joseph, he didn't know that, but his home was the pilgrimage. And this was the invitation. And I wonder what that would look like for us to see the pilgrimage as our home, the journey itself as our home. Do you guys know the artist Jean-Michel Basquiat? Yeah. So he's one of the most transformational artists of the 20th century. He's from New York. And so his version of home was fame. So there's a documentary called Radiant Child. I'll show you the trailer from it. You can rent it on Amazon. There's like a really low quality one on YouTube you could watch. But it follows his life. And so he grew up and he was homeless by the time he was 17. And through his art, his goal was to be famous. And he achieves it. So check out the clip.
Sal peanuts. Sal peanuts. The name of the song. Sal peanuts.
And it's worth watching. But in this documentary, you see that he has this dream. And he's so talented. Within 2 or 3 years from leaving home, he achieves his dream. And his ability to achieve his dream through so much talent, through so quickly. And he got there, and it was devastating. And that's why Jim Carrey says it like this. He says, I hope, go to the next one. I hope everyone could get rich and famous, so that they will have everything they dreamed of, so that they will know that it's not the answer. And I know for many of us, maybe it's probably not wealth or fame or success, but we have our version of that home. And what if we began this new year to make the discovery our vocation, that home, the discovery of our place in the city, our home, the discovery of our faith, that home. And I'll just close with this. And so this past March, our family took a road trip. And a friend of ours was getting married in the Muir Woods. You can show the picture. And so it was beautiful. So we were on the road, and we got to the Muir Woods. So that was the destination, and then we were coming home. And then on our way back, you go to the next slide, we went through Big Sur, and then Death Valley, and then Joshua Tree. So we had all these memories, and we had the destination, and then we were coming home. But I guarantee our best memory on that trip was, again, based on food, because I have all these beautiful memories growing up as a child of an immigrant, of my rice cooker, of the soy sauce eggs. And so we were like, we should do it, right? It's time. Let's get our rice cooker. Let's get some rice. Let's get some eggs. And so while we were driving there, it was our second day. We were almost at the Painted Desert in Arizona, and we were getting hungry. And so we go, Oh, what if we made rice in the car? By the time we get there, this is genius, right? This is only genius unless you're an engineer. Because we plug it into the first lighter, we're like, oh, doesn't work. Plug it in the next lighter, oh, doesn't work. And then none of our phones started, like, they stopped charging, all of them. And we blew all the fuses. So don't do that. You can't make rice in a vehicle. I think engineers know that, pastors don't. Lesson learned. So we took a picture to memorialize it. All right, you can take it off. And our memory had nothing to do on that trip of our destination or of home. But while we were on our pilgrimage, while we were on the road traveling. And my prayer for us, Vox, is that we won't be a community of ideology and propositional truth to protect and defend and to fight with. But we'll be a community of experiential truths that can be endlessly discovered. I pray that we won't be a community of ideology where we defend and we divide, but we'll welcome all on this road trip of faith where everyone is invited. So if you would pray with me. So in the footsteps of centuries of pilgrims, Vox, may you go now to embark on your pilgrimage. Consider your days. Travel lightly. Be alert to all that could sidetrack you. Notice what beckons alluringly or apparently with greater urgency. Receive the invitation that Christ gives us. Walk humbly. Know that the goal is not recognition or achievement or reward, but simply to know Christ and yourself more intimately and lovingly. Be on the lookout for other pilgrims, caring for all those who limp or fall or cannot see the way forward. And may we find life and wealth in the kingdom of God in this pilgrimage. And so go now, place your hand into the outstretched hand of Christ. Allow the words of our story to guide you. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.